Lecture 39, Macedonia, North of Mount Olympus.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. In this lecture, we return to the theme of imperialism, not of Athens, but of Macedonia, under Kings Philip II and Alexander the Great, and how the Greeks responded to Macedonian imperialism. In the first part of this lecture, we'll set the scene by examining details of Macedonian life, including social and political customs, and the issue of Macedonian ethnicity. Then in the second part of the lecture, we'll look briefly at Macedonia's turbulent history before Philip came to power in 359 BC, and how he became king when he was not next in line to the throne. We're going to be dealing with a remarkable king and an exciting reign, by the end of which Philip had increased Macedonia's size 3 or 4 times to include the whole of mainland Greece to as far east as Byzantium. He also more than doubled its population. And although we have no idea of population statistics, the population has been estimated at about 500,000. One thing I would like to say at the outset is that if you decide to read more on Macedonian history, you'll often see the place referred to as either Macedonia or Macedon. There is a difference. Macedonia is the term we use for the geographical area that was the Kingdom of Macedonia at any time in its history, whereas Macedon is the term for the political unit. I tend to use Macedonia because it's less confusing. The geographical barrier between Greece and Macedonia in antiquity was Mount Olympus. This was the home of the 12 Olympian gods and of the 9 Olympian muses. These were the daughters of Zeus and the goddess Memory. And it's still the highest mountain in Greece. You get spectacular views of it if you ever fly from Thessaloniki to Athens or vice versa, on a clear day that is. For much of its earlier history, Macedonia was divided into two parts. These two parts were Upper Macedonia to the west and Lower Macedonia to the east. Upper Macedonia, that's the western part, was an area of remote cantons inhabited by tribes largely independent of the king. Life there was tough, and the people living in Upper Macedonia were largely nomadic pastoralists. Because of the harsh climate, they mostly practiced transhumance. They moved their flocks of sheep, goats, and cattle to different pastures for food depending on the season. Lower Macedonia to the east had fertile soil as well as well-watered plains. These factors, along with a warmer climate generally, allowed the people to grow a variety of cereal crops and fruits, as well as to graze their livestock on the plains. The capital at Pella was also in Lower Macedonia. But because of the split between Upper and Lower Macedonia, the king was not king of all Macedonia. That's an important point. The king was often faced by hostilities from the peoples of Upper Macedonia, especially the group of people collectively referred to as the Illyrians. These Illyrians periodically invaded elsewhere in Macedonia. So because of these internal divisions, there was never any unity in the kingdom. There was always this split between upper and lower. And this split was something that Philip II addressed when he became king in 359. Unlike Greece, Macedonia was rich in natural resources, such as silver and gold, copper, iron, lead, and especially timber. Macedonian timber, along with that from the northern Chalcidice region, was the best shipbuilding timber in Greece. It was eagerly sought after by the Athenians, for example, for their fleet. and it explains the Athenians' interest in this northern region. If we cast our minds back for a moment, remember that the Athenian moves against Potidaea in 432, one of the immediate causes of the Peloponnesian War, as Thucydides tells us. These moves against Potidaea were to protect Athenian interests in the north for this timber, and also to keep an eye on the activities of the Macedonian king. But despite the abundance of natural resources in Macedonia, the economy was in a weak state before Philip. In fact, it was non-existent. Now, there was a chasm of a difference between the Macedonians and the Greeks, as is shown by social customs, political institutions, and possibly racial differences. And I'd like to deal with the matter of ethnicity now, but with some salutary caution. This is a very controversial area, and it still plays a role in modern Greek politics. Now, the ancient Greeks called the Macedonians barbarians, just as they called the Persians that. And in fact, the ancient Greeks were still calling the Macedonians barbarians as late as the final quarter of the 4th century BC. The Athenian orator Dinarchus has a reference to the destruction of Thebes at the hands of Alexander in 335, where he talks about the Thebans being distributed among the tents of the barbarian Macedonians. Now, as we know, the reference to another people as barbarian doesn't mean that they were uncivilized in our sense of the word. The high quality of the Macedonians' artwork, especially in mosaics and gold and silver metalwork, disproves that they were uncivilized. As we said in our discussion of the Persian Wars, the Greeks called anyone who didn't speak Greek a barbarian. They couldn't understand them, it sounded like this bar-bar sound, and hence they coined the term barbaroi, which first appears in Herodotus. However, the characterization of the Macedonians as barbarians, and therefore non-Greek speaking, has led to the still ongoing controversy as to whether the Macedonians were Greek or whether they were descended from a Balkan tribe. There is still no consensus on the issue of Macedonian ethnicity, whether the Macedonians were Greek, that is, or of mixed descent. And there probably never will be a consensus. And that's why the issue remains such a contentious one, especially in modern politics. But based on factors such as the literary sources, archaeological evidence, place names, and similarities in religion, I believe that all of this information can only point to the Macedonians being Greek and to speaking Greek. For example, the proper name for the Macedonians, that's Macedones, is a Greek word that means highlanders. The Macedonians had the same Greek pantheon as the Greeks. The god Dionysus was a particularly important one to the Macedonians. Towards the end of his reign, Alexander the Great, for example, came to identify himself more with Dionysus than with any other god or his Greek ancestors and heroes. And he was descended from Heracles on his father's side and Achilles on his mother's side. As far as the literary sources go, these span several centuries and all seem to agree on the one thing: the Macedonians were Greek. So our earliest source, the epic poet Hesiod, who was writing in the middle of the 8th century, and then Herodotus, who, as we know, was writing in the middle of the 5th century, and then someone as late as the Athenian orator Isocrates, writing in the later 4th century, all of these, over this period of time, had no problem tracing the origins of the first Macedonian king, a man called Perdiccas, to Argos in the Peloponnese. That's where the belief that the Macedonian ruling family came from. Perdiccas is also a Greek name. It may mean something like peridikaios, something to do with justice. Herodotus also tells us that Alexander I, now he was the king of Macedonia at the time of the Persian Wars, that Alexander I took part in the Olympic Games, and only Greeks could compete in these games. However, the Macedonians likely spoke a dialect, one that probably developed because of all of the different tribes with their dialects who lived on the borders of Macedonia. It was this Macedonian dialect that the Greeks presumably couldn't understand. And as a result, they called the Macedonians barbarians. We know that there was a dialect because Alexander spoke it twice, and we'll come on to that in later lectures. But for the most part, the Macedonians were speaking Greek. We never hear, for example, of Macedonian ambassadors to Athens, or vice versa, needing interpreters. And the Greek tragic playwright Euripides was invited to Macedonia, spent the last years of his life there, and he wouldn't have been writing plays in a language other than Greek. As I said, I'm comfortable believing the Macedonians were Greeks, and in my own work, I usually put in a disclaimer along the lines of, when I talk about Macedonians, I mean the Greeks north of Mount Olympus, and when I talk about Greeks, I mean the Greeks south of Mount Olympus. This disclaimer also applies to this and the next lectures on Macedonia, and so far it hasn't got me into trouble. Socially as well, the Greeks, that's those south of Mount Olympus, looked down their noses at the Macedonians. Two of the biggest cultural differences between Greeks and Macedonians were in the consumption of wine and polygamy. The Greeks drank their wine mixed. In other words, a combination of water, sometimes warm, sometimes cold, and wine. So they diluted their wine. To me, this is sacrilege. That meant that at their drinking parties or symposia, the Greeks wouldn't get drunk so quickly, and so they could take time as the evening progressed to focus on eating and discussing literary or philosophical works, current affairs, and things like that. Now, these symposia began in the late afternoon in someone's house, and they lasted until the wee small hours. But as the night wore on and the alcohol took over, the talk gave way to sex with the courtesans who were present. Respectable women, in other words, citizen women, were not allowed to attend symposia. So it was the courtesans, the non-citizen women, the upper-class prostitutes, the escorts for the discerning gentlemen. These were the ones who would dance to flute players before pairing off with the men present. The Macedonians, on the other hand, drank their wine neat or unmixed. The term is akratos. And the Greeks considered this a barbarian custom. It's what the Thracians and Scythians did, for example. Because the Macedonians drank their wine akratos, unmixed, they became drunk far quicker at their symposia. Our ancient sources talk of how they were too drunk to know what they were eating even when the first course was served, in other words, when the appetizer was put in front of them. That also meant that tempers would flare. The more alcohol you drink, often the more emotional you get, the more angry you can get. So I'm told. And we know, for example, that when Philip II married for the seventh time in 337 BC, he got very drunk at the wedding feast. And after a nasty exchange with his son Alexander, Philip tried to attack Alexander with his sword. But he fell over a table in a drunken stupor, and so Alexander didn't actually have to fight his father. Talking about Alexander, he was famous for his drinking, which sometimes resulted in him taking 2 days and nights to sleep off his drinking binges. And his drinking contests lasted for days. For example, in 324 at Persepolis, the Brahmin philosopher Kalanas committed suicide by self-immolation. This was the Brahmin custom. Funeral games were held in Kalanas's honor, and these included a drinking contest. Now, we're told by a contemporary source, which exists today in a fragment, that, and I'd like to quote here, "Of those who drank the wine, 35 died immediately of a chill, and 6 others died soon after in their tents. The man who drank the most quarts and received the talent, that's the victor, lived only 4 days more, and his name was Champion." I can't think of a more unfortunate name, can you? I should say, by the way, that Philip, or Alexander for that matter, were not alcoholics as we would describe someone like that today. They weren't drinking every minute of the day. They didn't crave a drink when they weren't having any. They did drink heavily, but that was only at certain times. Now, like the Greeks, Macedonians reclined to eat and drink at their symposia. However, in Macedonia, a man could not recline until he had killed a boar without a net. This was like an initiation rite. I find it somewhat amusing that the Greeks criticized the Macedonians for their social customs, yet Macedonians ate their food off plates while the Greeks ate off the table. Another cultural difference was polygamy. The Greeks frowned at this practice since in Athens at least, much importance was placed on the family unit, on the oikos, and on the legitimacy of children, as we discussed in previous lectures. Since only legitimate children could inherit the oikos, and these children were the product of one husband and one wife couple, it's not a surprise that the Macedonians were denounced for polygamy, just as the Spartans were for wife sharing. Macedonian kings, at least, had multiple wives, and usually the marriages were contracted for political reasons. Philip II married 7 times, and only his 7th wife, apparently, broke the pattern of political marriages, because the sources tell us he married her for love. I actually don't believe that, and I've got my own heresy about that, which I'll probably run by you in a later lecture. The downside of multiple wives is not merely multiple mothers-in-law, but also multiple heirs, and these could contend for the throne when the king died. So there's a political downside to having a number of marriages. It's hardly any wonder that the Macedonians had the reputation that they did as hard drinkers and rough, hard-living people. And I think this gave them a lot of satisfaction. There is no evidence for this, it's just a gut feeling on my part. But the Macedonians would have known about Greek social customs. Of course they did. They'd had plenty of contacts with Greeks. Remember how Alexander I was quick to ally with Xerxes during the Persian Wars, and how in the Peloponnesian War, Perdiccas II had alienated himself against the Athenians and then eventually come onto the side of the Spartans against Athens. The Macedonians also knew of the degree of social snobbery that the Greeks had for them, but they never tried to fit in with Greek social customs. And as I say, I have this instinct that this was deliberate, that the Macedonians embraced their image with gusto, that they wanted to be different, to be seen as different. They wanted to live up to an image, as today rock and roll stars feel that they have to. If you're not throwing a television out of a hotel room or trashing a hotel room because you didn't want brown M&Ms, you're not a rock star. Politically, if we can move away now from social customs to political institutions, Macedonia was a monarchy. The Macedonian government was composed of two halves, the king and the assembly. But in practice, the king's power was absolute. He was responsible for all domestic and foreign policy. He commanded the army. He was the final judge in cases of appeal. And he was the chief priest, whose duties included performing daily sacrifices for the well-being of the state. He was also the absolute authority in his own family, and that included arranging marriages for members of the royal family. This is a point I will pick up on when we deal with Alexander and the Persian royal princesses. The king's person had to be protected at all times, and so he was surrounded by a royal bodyguard of seven men that he personally selected. Being a member of the king's personal bodyguard was a great honor. Only the best would be considered. And so it's akin to the Secret Service protecting the president today. When a new king came to power, the people swore an oath of allegiance to him, and he responded in turn by promising to rule according to the law. What's more, the person of the king may have been semi-divine while alive, and when he died, he was deified. We know this happened with Philip's father and also with Philip himself. The other half of the Macedonian constitution was the assembly. This was composed of male citizens, noble and non-noble. When the king was on campaign, the government, so to speak, the assembly, travelled with him, which meant that when an assembly was held, it would be composed of only soldiers. This would have given it a different dynamic than when it was held in Pella, where non-soldiers could attend it, farmers, etc. The assembly discussed policy, it judged treason cases. Incidentally, it met under arms for this particular course of action. And it acclaimed a new king by the men clashing their spears on their shields. When there was a clear successor, usually the deceased king's eldest son, the assembly's acclamation was presumably a formality, and the king and the people then swore the oaths as I just mentioned. However, when the succession was disputed, or in times of emergency, the assembly could elect someone who was not next in line to the throne. And that's why in 359, the assembly bypassed the legal heir because he was a minor. And given the dangers facing Macedonia, as we'll come on to, the assembly decided to elect his uncle Philip as king. Philip was never regent. He was king from the word go. Now, Macedonia was in a dismal state before Philip became king in 359. It was a social, cultural, economic, and political backwater, with no centralized rule, as we said. It had a weak conscript army, it was rent by dynastic upheavals, and the interference in its domestic politics of cities like Athens and Thebes. It was also victimized by various tribes that lived on its borders. But by the time Philip was assassinated in 336 BC, after being king for only 23 years, Macedonia was the superpower of the ancient world. It had the best trained and toughest army, a centralized monarchy. It had imposed its hegemony over the Greeks, and Philip had even laid the plans for an invasion of Asia. To understand Philip's achievements better, I'm going to turn now to the second big part of my lecture and look briefly at Macedonian history before Philip. For much of its earlier history, Macedonia was plagued by interference from the tribes all around it and from elsewhere. Its closest neighbors were the Illyrians to the northwest and the Paeonians in the Axios Valley to the north. To the east, there were the kings of Thrace and the Greek cities of the Chalcidice, a prosperous area because of its harbors, natural resources, and fertile land. Before Philip, Macedonia used the ports on the Chalcidic coastline for its imports and exports, because its own coastline along the Thermaic Gulf was in Greek hands. However, relations between Macedonia and the Chalcidic League, which was headed by the city of Olynthus, were always uneasy. In fact, jumping ahead a bit, in the late 390s BC, the Olynthians seized parts of eastern Macedonia from Amyntas III, the father of Philip II. And in the 380s, the Olynthians backed a pretender to the throne that actually wrested power from Amyntas for a while. He actually only got his power back by allying with the Spartans, who came in to expel the pretender. To the southwest was the kingdom of Epirus, the modern Albania. And further south were Athens and Thebes. The Athenians especially interfered in Macedonia's domestic affairs, including supporting pretenders to the throne. They did this because of the timber, as I mentioned earlier, but also in a bid to regain Amphipolis. This was the colony that they'd established in 437 and which had been lost to Sparta in 424. If you remember, Thucydides the historian was exiled at this time, 424, because he didn't get to Amphipolis in time. And in 422, Cleon and Brasidas were killed in battle when Cleon was trying to reconquer Amphipolis. From that time onwards, the Athenians worked to get it back. And this factor becomes a major one in their policy in the north. Some of the earlier Macedonian kings had tried to combat foreign incursions and even took on the Illyrians, because it was the Illyrians who represented the greatest threat to Macedonian security. These kings included Alexander I and Perdiccas II, but their attempts ultimately came to nothing. Things changed somewhat during the reign of Archelaus. He was king from 413 to 399. Now, technically, he was not next in line, but he'd seized the throne by killing his uncle, that's Perdiccas' brother, and his son, in other words, Archelaus' cousin. See what I mean about dynastic upheavals? But Archelaus made some serious attempts to forge unity and stimulate trade. He enhanced the army, perhaps with new weaponry for the infantry. And he built roads to help with military communications and trade. Thucydides actually says that Archelaus did more for Macedonia than the eight kings before him. What's more, in 399, at the end of his reign, Archelaus founded a new capital at Pella, with a view perhaps to trade. Pella was located on a branch of the Ludias River that ran into the Thermaic Gulf, which in turn ran out into the Aegean and the main trade routes. In this period, by the way, Pella was coastal, whereas today, because of the silting of the sea, it's about 22 miles inland. The original capital of Macedonia was at Agai, a place that means the place of goats, the modern Vergina. However, Agai continued to be used for royal weddings and burials, but it was Pella that became the center of Macedonia, the capital. Archelaus also wanted to extend the cultural pull of his capital. Xerxes of Italy, the leading fresco painter, decorated Archelaus' palace, and the king perhaps established a school for artists, especially of mosaics, and this school was still influential in the Hellenistic and Roman periods. Archelaus invited Socrates and Euripides to his court. Well, Socrates declined the invitation, principally because of the way Archelaus seized power. But Euripides wrote at least two plays there, including the Bacchae, about the power of Dionysus. And this play may well mirror the Wild West style of Macedonia. Archelaus, however, had not united Macedonia, nor had he created a strong dynastic line. The weak reigns of his successors proved his failings, as these kings undid most of Archelaus' accomplishments. Serious threats from the Illyrians, the Chalcidian League, and the Athenians caused further havoc in Macedonia. But the nail in the coffin seemed to come in 359, when the Dardanians, an Illyrian tribe, invaded Macedonia again. The Dardanians were led by the chieftain Bardylis, who was about 90 by then. But age didn't slow him down, he was one tough fighter. Bardylis and his Dardanians brought the Macedonian king at the time, Perdiccas III, and the Macedonian army to battle and defeated them. Perdiccas and 4,000 Macedonians were killed at that battle. The Dardanians and perhaps also other Illyrian tribes, as well as the Paeonians, now massed to invade Macedonia. At the same time, two pretenders, one backed by a king of Thrace, the other backed by Athens, made a bid on the Macedonian throne. To make matters worse, Perdiccas' son and heir, Amyntas, was only a minor. We don't know how old he was. A later Roman source called Justin refers to him as Parvalus, a little lad. So it appears that Macedonia's already melancholy history was about to get worse. But then the assembly did something that would forever change Greek history. It set aside Amyntas and it acclaimed his uncle, the dead king's brother, Philip, as king. And under Philip, Macedonian history would change in a way that no Greek, north or south of Olympus, would ever have envisaged in 359. And we'll see how Philip ended the threats to Macedonia in that year, how he united the kingdom, and how he extended its influence south of Mount Olympus in our next lecture. Thank you very much.